with a liberal theologian on the JEPD theory. I noticed tonight in our selection of faculty, we have a J for Jim and a P for Perry and a D for Dwayne. And I'm glad tonight we have a Robert. And I'm glad his mother didn't name him anything else that started with an E. Dr. Robert C. Newman is professor of New Testament at Biblical Theological Seminary, which is a graduate school about a half an hour north of Philadelphia in Hatfield, Pennsylvania. He's also the director of IBRI, Interdisciplinary Biblical Research Institute. As a student at Duke University, if I understand correctly, he became greatly concerned and disturbed at the liberalism that he was being taught, not so much by evolutionists, but it was in fact those who claimed to be Christians. And so this was one of the things that motivated him to become an apologist and to begin his career of defending the faith, and he has participated in a number of debates along that line in public forums. He has a PhD in theoretical astrophysics from Cornell University. In addition to that, he holds several master's degrees in theology, an MDiv and an STM. And this gives him a particularly interesting background as he has developed his life around this type of a Bible science interface ministry. There are many things that could be said about him. In addition to his outstanding academic achievements, he is known as a rigorous professor who doesn't let you off easy. And above all else, he's known as a Christian gentleman. So please welcome Dr. Robert C. Newman.
Thank you, Daryl. It's a pleasure to be with you all here this evening. This is the first time I've had a chance to try out something of this sort. I've spoken on college campuses on a number of occasions and in churches and things of that sort, but first time to have a discussion on the age of the earth with the real guys. So, actually, Daryl's remark about JDP, I'm not sure how well that works out. There are a number of people who've called me Alfred E. Newman. So that's not really my name. In starting out our discussion, I'd like to point out that I, too, agree with Brothers Gish and Stambaugh, and Dr. Phillips also agrees with me, that the Bible is God's Word, that He has inerrantly revealed to us not only what we need to be saved, not only what we need to know about God, but He's revealed to us what He has done in history and what He's done in the area we call science. The Bible is thoroughly reliable in all of these areas. Bible, science, history, what man is like, what God is like, and the man isn't so hot. He's made all right, but he has gone after many inventions, as the writer of Ecclesiastes says. There's been a long and stormy history in this whole creation-evolution debate. Part of it has arisen from realization as geology was studied in the 1700s and early in the 1800s that the Earth did not look like it was only a few thousand years old. And there was a rather substantial, though not universal, consensus among geologists already by the 1840s, full 15 years, before the publication of Darwin's Origin of Species, that went in that direction, that suggests that the motivation, at least on the part of many, for a old Earth was not attempting to open room for evolutionary theories. There were certainly evolutionary theories around. There have been evolutionary theories around since 500 years before the time of Christ. But they did not achieve scientific respectability until the work of Charles Darwin, particularly his work with the finches on Galapagos and other materials of that sort. I also should point out that the rise of this sort of thing is a type of challenge that Christianity has faced throughout its history and that the people of God before the coming of Christ had faced, and that is that the Lord allows various challenges to come to us in our lives individually, in our lives collectively. And these challenges come to us politically, as the Assyrians came over the hill, headed for Jerusalem, but they also come to us in scientific areas as well. The Bible is certainly presented to us in its own claims to be a sufficiently clear revelation of God that we have all we need to be able to trust in Him and to know what we need to do for our salvation. And yet, the Bible is not as clear as it could be. And there are a number of rather easy examples to show this for us. First of all, we have several examples in Jesus' own career where the disciples misunderstood him. we have the rather interesting remark in Scripture that the prophecies regarding the first coming of Christ were structured in such a way that even Satan was faked out when Jesus and his Father brought eternal redemption through the death of Jesus. So that Paul can say, if the rulers of this age had known, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory. I think what we need to realize is that God has more than the agenda of making things clear to us as he could in what he is doing in history, in science, and in his word. He has, in addition, an agenda in which we will be surprised at various points about what he is doing. And that surprise will remind us that God is in control of history, that Satan is not going to outsmart God, that man is not going to outsmart God, but God will outsmart them. My suggestion is that one of these agendas is to let mankind, in seeking to rebel against God, do their best in the areas of science, and yet they will find again and again, if they are fair to the material, that that material points them back to the creator of the universe, just as the material of the Bible, fulfilled prophecy, changed lives, points them that this creator of the universe is also the God of the Bible. Now, throughout Christian history, there have been a number of places where sincere Christians have thought the Bible taught something that turned out, with the investigation of science, that that wasn't what the Bible taught. I don't know whether any of you believe the earth is flat or not. There have been many people who thought the earth was flat and thought the Bible taught it. I don't think they were right. There are still, believe it or not, a fair number of people today who think the Bible teaches the sun goes around the earth and not the earth around the sun, and they would use arguments with some similarity to those being used here by Brother Gish to argue for that thing and feel themselves to be the real consistent creationists. I suggest Your Heart is a Bowel, a book with every wind of doctrine, 1984, R.G. Elmendorf, How to Scientifically Trap, Test, and Falsify Evolution, 1978, Marshall and Sandra Hall, The Connection Between Evolution Theory and the Coming Together of the True Church, 1977, James Hansen, A New Interest in Geocentricity, 1979, Edward F. Hill's Space Age Science, 1964, second edition, 1979, as all persons who believe themselves to be consistent Christians, consistently following the Bible, and not letting science lead them by the nose, because they believe that the earth is at the center and the sun is going around it, and that's what the Bible clearly says, they would say. I would suggest, in fact, that the biblical statements are standard sort of statements, just like astronomers use today when we talk about the sun rising. I've run into very few scientists who talk about the eastern horizon lowering or our moving eastward at 1,000 miles an hour. There's actually not even very good expressions in that direction, though you could invent one if you worked on it a while. My suggestion is, and I'll try and develop this a little bit this evening, that as our brother Gish has mentioned, the question of the age of the earth is not very closely connected with evolution. It does not appear that if we had billions of times 5 billion years, that we would be able to get any evolution out of that sort of thing. We will try to respond to some of the remarks that Brother Gish has made regarding cosmology and such tomorrow, see how that works out, and I will not attempt to adjust to deal with those things this evening. I would suggest that there has been a confusion, I would say, in the fact that many persons have called the origin and development of the universe as evolution, and then that has caused many Christians to react to that as though that is evolution, dirty word, and connect it with biological evolution. I think we have got some very good evidence for an old Earth and an old universe, but the evidence for evolution does not point in the direction of biological origin of life from non-life by purely natural processes, the development of life by natural processes, anything of that sort. I do think we have some fairly good evidence that the universe is old and that it's doing something like the sort of thing that we would envision in a Big Bang theory. It does not mean that the standard Big Bang theory presented by people who do not believe in any intervention are necessarily correct. It may be a number of the problems which Brother Gish has raised are, in fact, evidences where God has intervened. Some of the others, I think, have simpler explanations or non-supernatural explanations. We'll have a look at those by and by. What I'd like to do, then, this evening, is look at the whole question of evolution, of a biological sort. I try to make two distinctions here. I'd like to distinguish our discussion of origins into two types of models. We'll call them creation models and evolution models. There's been some discussion in creationist circles, and I think it's a very sound discussion, of the need for two models to be presented in public classroom. And I think that's a fair concern. And my suggestion would be that these models should be fairly generic rather than very, very specific, because it will be very hard otherwise to get around the sort of charges which you do see in the courts that you are trying to teach religion in the public school. I think, as a matter of fact, religion is being taught in the public schools, that religion is secular humanism. But I think in coming back at that, by arguing that there ought to be equal time for Christianity, the Buddhists are going to say there ought to be equal time for Buddhism, and the Muslims are certainly going to want at least equal time for Islam, and such on down the line. I think there's a better way to deal with the matter that is still scientific, and yet gives the student in public education a better idea of where things really stand. And that would be the presentation of evolution and creation models. Here's my suggestion for evolution, the definition of an evolution model. The origin life from non-life and the development of its present diversity is the result of purely natural processes. A creation model, then, would suggest that the origin of life from non-life and the development of its present life's present diversity is the result of one or more supernatural interventions in the natural processes. I don't think you can come anywhere near getting by with one, frankly, but I think that is kind of where the dividing line is. The dividing line is there any evidence of supernatural intervention? If there is, that would favor a creation model. Is it clear that we don't need any supernatural intervention? Then that is an indication that an evolution model is, in fact, the sort of thing. Now, you'll frequently get in this kind of situation a complaint that, well, wait a minute. This is science. This is religion. Well, as a matter of fact, a number of religions floating around today have evolution as one of their major features. So the evolution is certainly connected with a number of religions. I have a pamphlet out in our IBRI table there called Evolution Religion. And it points out the rather interesting fact that in the Arkansas trial, a number of people who were against the teaching of creation in the public schools were in fact major officials in your mainline denominations in this country. And the reason for that is they believe that evolution is the way it happened. And it's a part of their religion, because they also believe that something like evolution is what happened when the books of the Bible developed. I will not wander off into the JED theory in spite of the temptation by Darrell to do something of that sort. My suggestion is that we are dealing here with two alternative definitions of science. And unfortunately, there is frequently in argument, a trading around between the two definitions in such a way that the person doesn't know which one is being used at a particular point. One can define science as a method of explanation using only natural processes. Well, if a person would like to use that term for science, they may do so, but has slight disadvantage. If there are any events in the history of our universe in which something other than natural processes are the explanation for what actually happened, then this method is not going to find them. It's going to try to paper them over in one way or another, and it therefore becomes a word game. In fact, it's more common, at least among average persons, to think of science as an attempt to explain how things really are. I mean, you'd need to prove that some, but science is an attempt to describe the real world. And if we're attempting to describe the real world and a number of important phenomena in it are actually supernatural interventions, then that ought to show up in our explanation somewhere. I think, in fact, that's the case. Now, we're inside the universe. We're not outside looking in. And so we may not be able to tell in detail what it was that was done at that point to produce that result. But I think we do see evidences. We'd expect supernatural phenomena to look probably at some places as though they are discontinuities because something has happened into our world and produced a discontinuity of some sort. And so the thing then would be to look around in our universe in the various areas of science and see if we find evidence of discontinuities of various sorts. Places where it looks like something has happened that doesn't appear to be the outworking of any natural law we know about, and in fact does not appear to be the outworking of a natural law. What I'd like to do with you in the time we've got available then this evening is take a look at three areas of problem with the theory of biological evolution. These three areas are the problem of the origin of life, the problem of the fossil record, and the problem of the evolutionary mechanism. Let's start, first of all, with the whole question of the origin of life. As Brother Gish has suggested for us already, life is pretty complicated stuff. I've got an overhead for this, but I just reshuffled my talk slightly. There it is there. I've got an overhead projector image of a typical living cell, and it looks fantastically simpler than a real cell does. Brother Duane gave you a little picture of a closer approximation to what a real cell looks like. I've only put one of each of these things in there. I remember when I was younger, taking biology, cytoplasm was sort of the juice inside the cell, but it's pretty complicated juice. It has got thousands of molecules, many of them thousands of atoms large. All of them, as far as we can tell, specifically fitted to carry out various activities inside the cell. One of the most striking of these activities is the activity of the enzymes. Enzymes are chemicals which allow physical processes, chemical reactions inside the cell to go at millions of times faster than they would ordinarily go under those temperature regimes. Without enzymes, a cell would be able to function millions of times slower than it does. Say, oh, well, wait a minute, you can just raise the temperature a bit and you'll run those reaction rates up millions of times faster. That's right. But you raise the temperature a bit and you find out that the agitation of the things moving around breaks up all the long chemicals. You don't have a functional cell to operate with. So just that cytoplasm is a very complicated sort of thing. It's been suggested by some that the typical living cell is like a complicated factory. Some even suggest like a complicated city. We were discussing at dinner tonight whether the eukaryotic cell should be compared to New York City and the prokaryotic cell to Chicago, but I won't try to solve that particular question. Carl Sagan is well known as an evolutionist. His work in the Cosmos series has certainly been widely spread around, PBS series that then has been shown in school after school after school. He also wrote the article entitled Life that appeared in the last two editions of the Encyclopedia Britannica. In giving us a little feel for the complexity of the living cell, he makes this statement, a little bit of computer jargon. The information content of a simple cell has been estimated at around 10 to the 12th power bits. And then, since most people know what 10 to the 12th power bits is, comparable to about 100 million pages of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Of course, most people, none of us, I don't, have much feel for what 100 million pages are. So I decided to try and convert that into something else. And I looked at our Encyclopedia Britannica we had sitting in a seminar library and noticed there are about 1,000 pages per volume and about 25 volumes, I think it was actually 24 volumes, about 25 volumes per set. This works out to 4,000 sets in Encyclopedia Britannica. Not 4,000 identical sets in Encyclopedia Britannica, but a library as big as 4,000 sets in Encyclopedia Britannica, but all the information is different. That's the information content of a simple cell. Well, how did that get here? Well, evolutionists would tell us that got here by a sequence of chemical reactions which may have been likely or may have been very unlikely. It's at least Carl Sagan's way of stating it. And he kind of hopes it's likely, I think, but is beginning to doubt whether that's really the case. The origin of life has had a number of people seeking to explain it on naturalistic terms and usually have proposed a multi-step process. I've seen four-step and that sort of thing, but I'm going with a three-step process here. The first step is the claim that simple organic chemicals, sugars, amino acids, the nucleotide bases, etc., they were formed early in the Earth's history by the action of some kind of energy source. Maybe ultraviolet, maybe lava from volcanoes, maybe lightning from clouds. These things acted on an atmosphere which is called a reducing atmosphere, an atmosphere that lacks free oxygen, and its oxygen is combined only into certain kind of compounds which tend to unoxidize things rather than oxidize things. Suggestions have varied a fair bit. The one I have here, water, carbon dioxide, ammonia, methane. The idea is these reactions, these chemicals are present in the atmosphere, and ultraviolet light coming down breaks up some of them. Or lightning striking, passing through the atmosphere in certain places, breaks up some of these. And then they come back together, and some of them, of course, come back together into water, carbon dioxide, ammonia, methane, but some of them come back together into certain sugars or amino acids or things of that sort, and these drift down until they settle in the ocean and then develop a soup, it's generally called. Estimates on how thick the soup is suggest that it would not be very nourishing if you were to be there and expect to live off of it. This has received a great deal of hoopla in the press because an action of this sort has been done in the laboratory a number of times. The earliest one was the Miller-Urey experiment in the 50s, and it's continued on to this day. Various attempts to do this, in which basically what is done is these gases are piped past some kind of energy source, typically a spark, and then cooled off and run through a water solution where the soluble stuff will stay put and not go past that spark again so it gets broken up. And if you run this for several weeks, you will in fact get some sugars, you will get some amino acids, etc., but you'll get all kinds of other stuff. You will get not only some of the amino acids that occur in living things, or 20 that occur in living things, and you get some of those, but you'll get all kinds of other amino acids that don't occur in living things. There's never been an experiment in which you get all of the amino acids that occur in living things. There has never been a sequence of different experiments with slightly different conditions that have got all of the 20 of them. The result is that some look very promising. Of course, persons who are strongly committed to a naturalistic origin will say, well, someday we'll find the right conditions. Robert Shapiro, chemist at New York University, I believe he is, has written a book, A Skeptic's Guide to the Creation of Life on Earth. He has a very humorous scenario, kind of mocking this, although he finally winds up with something like this kind of a view, in which he has a little tidal pond in which you get some of the right kind of stuff formed, but then that tidal pond runs off to another little tidal pond somewhere else under different conditions, and there you form a couple of the others, and then it runs off to another, and you form some of the others, and off to another, and it really... You really are chuckling about it before you get the end, and that's really what he intends. This is a very, very short step. If the atmosphere of the Earth was right, and if we had the right kind of reactions, yes, you might get some of this. You're certainly not going to get much in an ocean, and there's no reason to believe you're going to get all the stuff you need. But this is a minute step. Again, you see typically in the media, which is not a great place to get your science from, you see typically in the media that a kind of life has almost been created with these sort of things. But if we think in terms of life as 4,000 sets in Encyclopedia Britannica, you've moved from three-letter words to five-letter words here. You haven't got any sentences yet, you haven't got any chapters, you haven't got any books, three-letter words to five-letter words. The other two steps are quite a bit larger than the first step. It's not obviously designed by an architect where you steps to the front porch, you know, are three the same size, but kind of like the situation where the fellow... walked out a door on the second floor, and it turned out there was no stairway under that door. Fell two stories, laying there on the ground groaning. A fellow looks out the door upstairs, and he says, "What's trouble?" He says, "You better watch out. That's a big step there." This is a big step here. To go from simple organic compounds, sugars, amino acids, nucleotide bases, etc., to the actual kind of molecules that occur in living things, the proteins, the DNA, the RNA, we're moving from 10, 15, 20 atoms to linkages of these things that for the simplest proteins are about 100 amino acids long. As Brother Gish has mentioned, 400 or 500 for more typical proteins, and many, many times larger than that for your bigger proteins. When you're talking DNA, you are really talking some large stuff. You're often there talking several million nucleotide base pairs. So very, very long, complicated things. Well, how do you get up there? Well, in living things, it's not hard. Living plants and animals have a complex machinery to assemble this stuff. They've got a information tape that tells you what order these things go in, and they've got a way of delivering that part of the information you need out to the construction sites, the mitochondria, in your ribosome, in your cell. And then they've got out there little messengers that go around and pick up the various amino acids needed and hook them together, and the result is you build up these things very, very rapidly. But you've got a very complicated program running to set these things up. But we've got to back up to when there wasn't any program like that. and ask how you get the things under those conditions. Well, it is possible under certain conditions to put together small molecules and get larger molecules. We call it polymerization. Polymerization does not take place well in a thin soup like the ocean would be, and so you've got to get out of that situation. So what do? Well, you slosh a little bit of it on land, you get a pond, and then you begin to evaporate that as well as you can. If you evaporate it too much, you get back into another problem. You're back out in the ultraviolet light again. So you've got to move your tidal pond indoors. Put your tidal pond in a cave. Okay? Well, that cuts down the number of scenarios a good deal. You've got to move from tidal ponds that form out in the open to tidal ponds that form in caves. So now you begin to build up the stuff. And then, lo and behold, you're going to get all this polymerization, right? Wrong. You don't just have nice pure amino acids or nice pure nucleotide bases or pure sugars. You've got all that mixed up with all this other sludge and all these other amino acids that don't occur in life. And you've got left-hand amino acids with right-hand amino acids, and you've got right-hand sugars with left-hand sugars. All these competing reactions going on. But in life, you've got left-hand amino acids, right-handed sugars. You don't have left-handed sugars and right-handed amino acids. And you don't have all these other hundreds of amino acids that can be made, but don't occur in living things. It looks very much like something's been designed here, which is not really surprising when you see how all the stuff fits together. When you see that you've got just the right enzymes to make certain reactions go millions of times faster than they would go otherwise. That is a big, big step. And nobody's even been able to do a very good job of that in a laboratory, where you're able to purify the stuff, put the stuff together under the right pH, that sort of thing. But we're talking about doing this out there in nature. Your last step, biopolymers combine to form living cells. Doesn't sound too bad when you say it that way. Except it's got to have all the right biopolymers. Carl Sagan has pointed out a rather serious problem at this particular point. You wonder why he's pointing it out. Well, because he's trying to deal with the information. He's trying to see what kind of a problem we've got. And we've got a problem. The problem is that you've got kind of your chicken-egg situation again. To unload the DNA information out of its headquarters in the nucleus and put it on a truck to carry the information over to where you're going to build your proteins and enzymes, you need a catalyst to transfer that information, an enzyme. And then when you get over there where you're going to build it, you need an enzyme to unload the information. And then when you make your enzymes, you need a catalyst, enzyme, to do that. Without those actions, you don't get the things made. But the place where you make these enzymes is right over there. And that is a serious problem. Sagan presents the problem this way. So far as known, he says, polynucleotides, RNA, DNA, have no catalytic properties. They have no tendency to speed up reactions. And proteins have no reproductive properties. They have no tendency to make copies of themselves. It's only the partnership of the two molecules that makes contemporary life on Earth possible. Accordingly, a critical and unsolved problem in the origin of first life is, is the first functional relation between these two molecules, or equivalently, the origin of the genetic code. Notice those two remarks? Now, if you've been hearing in the media, evolution's a fact. No. Like the Earth is round. Like gravity occurs. What you're getting is a little bit of a shell game going on there. There's taking evidence of mutation. Mutation occurs, and certainly there's some natural selection going on. Fatal mutations take those guys out of the race. Occasionally, you have what is either a mutation or perhaps a growth of existing population, where something is able to respond effectively to DDT, malaria, things of that sort. But when those particular things are removed, those particular members of the population seem to be not so effective in functioning. But that's not the same thing as getting from non-life to life. And that's not even the same thing as getting from single-celled life to multi-celled life, and multi-celled life to the profusion of things that show up at the Cambrian explosion that Brother Gish mentioned for you, nor even getting between reptiles and amphibians and birds and fish and such. Big difference. There are some very, very serious problems with the origin of life. But there are some very serious problems with fossil record, and I'm not going to do much for you here, except to point out, as Brother Gish has mentioned before, that in the first place, when we talk about missing links, there are an awful lot of links in the fossil record, we see all sorts of things showing up in the fossil record, apparently suddenly. This is the way George Gaylord Simpson says, talking about gaps in the fossil record. In spite of these examples, and the kind of examples he's talking about is an apparent transitional sequence in the horses, apparent transitional sequence in some of the shellfish, that sort of thing. In spite of these examples, he says it remains true, as every paleontologist knows, every person that studies fossil record, that most new species, genera and families, moving up in the subdivisions of how to categorize living things, and that nearly all categories above the level of families appear in the fossil record suddenly and are not led up to by known, gradual, completely continuous sequences. And then further on, it's a fact that discontinuities are almost always and systematically present in the origin of really high categories. Darwin, when he first proposed his theory, proposed that everything was gradually changing. And the paleontologists at that time said, what? We certainly don't see evidence of that in the fossil record. When we look in the fossil record, we can identify the various kinds of plants and animals we see in the fossil record. They're not always quite the same as they are today, but they fit into the categories we have today. And Darwin's answer was, well, the fossil record's incomplete. And as the fossil record becomes more and more complete as we study it, then these gaps will fill in. Well, that was 1859. By the time you get down to about 1929, that's 70 years after Darwin's time, the gaps aren't filling in. And so now evolutionists begin to move to a different model, which is often called the neo-Darwinian synthesis or the new synthesis. And this is a claim that the reason why these gaps aren't filling in is that all your important evolution takes place with small populations that are isolated. Well, there's one slight advantage of a small isolated population, and that is it's easier for a particular mutation to get a foothold in a population of 10 or 20 or 100 individuals than it is to get a foothold in 1,000 or 1,000,000 or 1,000,000,000 individuals. That's pretty straightforward. But we're not talking about one mutation getting a foothold. The kind of mutations you need to get across the various phyla in living things are way out of that category. So where is all of that? Where is all of that? The neo-Darwinian synthesis is still probably the major view at this current time, although a competitor has arisen in recent years, and that attempts to explain something the neo-Darwinian model did not explain, and that's the stability of species. When you look in the fossil record, you see species that last for a far longer time than any reasonable time for their getting started. And Darwin's model wouldn't predict that particularly. You think changes are going all the time. Change ought to be the thing that's happening all the time. Whereas you're actually seeing in the record, stability is what's the characteristic feature. And so the model called punctuated equilibrium has been developed. Punctuated, at different points, sudden changes occur. These guys do not believe that a bird hatches out of a reptile's egg, although there are evolutionists who made such proposals. But they believe that quickly on a geologic scale, changes take place and you shift over to new species. But once you get to that species, that is an equilibrium. And that will resist change and then will stay in that particular area. This is not a bad treatment of the phenomena of the fossil record. The trouble is, geneticists don't have any mechanism that will do that. And so paleontologists want a mechanism. The geneticists can't give them one. What's going on? Well, looks to me like, older creation's position, God has intervened to make a new kind there. So it shows up suddenly in fossil record. Whether he made a couple of them, and then it takes several thousand years for them to spread over the earth enough to show up in fossil record, or whether he made billions of them, and they show up instantaneously in the fossil record, is something, as far as I can tell, you can't tell from the ability to look at fine detail in the fossil record. That is a serious problem with the fossil record. The fossil record does not suggest the gradual transition of each form of life from simpler forms of life. We want to look at one last thing in our time this evening, and that is problems with the evolutionary mechanism. The standard evolutionary mechanism is mutation and natural selection. That actually doesn't start with Darwin, because Darwin did not know about mutation as we think of it now, but he thought varieties arose somehow, and then those varieties which are more favorable to the survival and reproduction of the organism, those were the ones that went out. And as these show up, then that's what's going on. It's only been in this century that evidence of mutation has begun to be more clear, and it was only actually fairly recently that we began to get much of a handle on exactly what was going on there. That something happens in the copying of the DNA that makes a change. That something may happen because the mechanism skips in some way. All the mechanisms man can make don't always work quite right. There are a number of rather interesting things of that sort. The science fiction story where you are inside a spaceship headed for the nearest star, and your whole life is under the control of this benevolent robot, and he's going to keep the environment under control, and he's going to guide the ship in the right direction, and you are just getting ready to inject yourself with the drug that's going to put you under for 25 years until you get near the star, and as you're just putting the stuff in, you hear the robot say, "Everything is under control. Is under control. Is under control. Is under control." In our fallen world, that's the way mechanisms are. And one way, then, in which mutations can occur is when the mechanism skips something or another. Another way is if it's interfered with, cosmic ray, certain types of chemicals introduced, that sort of thing. That's one of the reasons why you hardly feel like you can eat anything anymore these days. But though it's dangerous to be overweight, I know that, I'm not doing as well as I should, it's pretty dangerous to go without eating for more than a year. So, in this whole question of mutation and natural selection, the idea is that mutation produces the varieties, but there's no particular influence in the environment on it. The environment can't call up needed mutations. The mutations produce the variety, and natural selection pick out the better ones. And the result is, supposedly, that life gets more and more able to adapt to its environment. And yet, when we look at present-day life, we see that there are lots of complicated beings out there. In fact, we don't really know much about any kind of simple life. And some of these complicated beings have got lots of different parts, which we call organs. And most of these organs are pretty complicated. Eyes are pretty complicated. They certainly make video recording equipment look pretty simple. Wings, pretty complicated. I can't even begin to describe them. Sure, Brother Gish could do a better job on the description of those things than I can. But the design of each of the wings so that they fit together, they produce a right kind of flow around one another, they lock together somewhat like Velcro does, very nicely fit for flying. And yet, according to evolution, they were developed from scales. Poison fangs, we don't like to think of them as nice particularly, since there are not too many uses that are favorable to man for poison fangs, but they're another complicated system as well. You've got a whole system for making the poison. You've got a system for delivering that to the tooth. You've got a tooth that works like hypodermic needle. When our teeth have holes in them, they don't work as well. How do you work your way into these kind of elaborate systems and complex organs? Well, there are really a couple of choices. You can have a whole series of individual mutations, each of which makes the thing more viable than before, and somehow they move themselves over into a complicated organ or a complicated system. Metabolism, photosynthesis, nervous system, that sort of thing. But when we actually look at life, we see a rather striking thing. We see optimization. We can't always tell whether something's absolutely the best it could be, but we know these things are up there pretty close. People can complain that, you know, human eyes aren't as good as eagle eyes or things of that sort. Well, yeah, but humans don't need to do some of the things eagles do. It's a very nice adaptation of the the various functions to be able to run at high illumination in color and at low illumination in black and white. To be able to, when everything is tuned up in the black and white mode, to be able to detect just a little above one photon. Very, very, down at the bottom sort of situation. How do you get that? Well, mutation produces a variety. Natural selection chooses the better one for survival. Question. How strong is selection? How strong is natural selection? Well, it's got to be strong enough to optimize. How do you optimize something? The only way you optimize something, make it kind of the best it can be, is it must weed out all the other stuff. If it's strong enough to optimize, then it weeds out neutral mutations. Nice illustration that John Bloom uses at our Origin seminars is your idea that you're going to convert your Volkswagen into a Cadillac. Piece by piece. Put on, you buy a Cadillac wheel at the junkyard, or if you're really snazzy, you go down to the parts dealer. Although if you go to the parts dealer, you're going to spend about $50,000 for the $15,000 Cadillac. So you go to the junkyard, you'll spend probably $20,000 for it there, but go to the junkyard, you get a Cadillac wheel. Wrong number of bolts. Won't fit under the fender. Then you've got to switch your engine. Four-cylinder rear, air-cooled. Talking plugs. Eight-cylinder, water-cooled. Front. See, that is the kind of thing you see in living things as well. You see two-chambered hearts, three-chambered hearts, four-chambered hearts. How do you run a heart when you're changing number of chambers? You see lungs that breathe in and breathe out. But the birds have flow-through lungs. Air passes one direction only through the lungs. Exit on one end, entrance on the other end. They both got to come back to where they breathe with, obviously. But how do you switch from one to the other? If neutral mutations are weeded out, all change must follow paths of constant improvement. But many organs and systems consist of several parts which are useless unless all of them are present. What survival advantage does a reptile have whose front legs are changing into wings? But they're not far enough along to fly with yet. They're not even far enough along to catch bugs with yet. But they don't run very well. Going downhill. Well, those are the kind of things. I have several examples here. I will not go into them. The bombardier beetle is a rather striking one. A beetle that has a jet propulsion system on the back end, not used for propulsion, but used for blasting its opponents. Poison fang we've already mentioned up the road here. The sex wasp, a rather interesting article by Lauren Isley near the end of his life about this particular type of large solitary wasp that in preparing for its young, goes, builds a place where it's going to put the eggs, goes out and gets a caterpillar, stings that caterpillar in just the right way to paralyze it, but not strong enough to kill it. It knows where to put the stuff, the poison, and how much to put, so that the caterpillar is not dead meat, as they say today, but live meat. Because dead meat rots in refrigeration or freeze-drying, live meat. Puts the egg in the hole, puts the caterpillar in the hole, somehow the new wasp that hatches out inside, not having been trained by its mother, knows what parts of the caterpillar to eat, so it's not killed by it, until it's at least had a very substantial amount of the meat, which is needed. Striking example, how do you evolve into something of that sort? How do you evolve complicated guidance phenomena? Well, there's an answer that's been suggested. That answer is that you turn off a bunch of genes you aren't needing. You copy extra genes, but you can't turn off one you need, obviously. You copy a bunch of genes that you're using, but you've got a double set of them, and you turn off one set of them. And then you let them sit around for a while and evolve into something good. So you take a bunch of scale genes, and you turn them off, and then you evolve them into feather genes, and then you turn them on. Boom, you got feathers. That's pretty neat. Will it work? Well, it's probably work if God was guiding it, okay? Will it work if there's no God to guide it? Well, it's a rather interesting calculation this done by a Swiss researcher named Peter Rist. He says, okay, look, this information to make these proteins that say are going to be, we're just going to take a little simple part of it, a protein that's going to be part of a set of protein, that's made by making changes in the DNA. Now, the DNA coding system uses 3 base pairs, and that makes 1 amino acid. And there are 64 different kinds of triplet base pairs, and they code for 20 amino acids plus 3 stops, 3 indicators to stop a reading at that point. If you take the ones that actually code for amino acids, it turns out then 3.05 of these codons, 61 codons, 20 amino acids, 3.05 codons on the average on amino acid. Then you say, okay, suppose we start with a particular amino acid. How many mutations do you need? How many mutations do you need the DNA to get from one amino acid to another amino acid? Well, of the 61 amino acids, you need one mutation to get 9 of them to change to 9 of them. You need 2 mutations to change to 27 of them, and 3 mutations to change to 27 more. And if I haven't watched up the numbers, that adds up to 61. If you then take an average of that, and Rist took a geometric mean of that, which works better than if you take a arithmetic mean, you need 2.16 mutations on the average to get to a particular amino acid from whatever one you started with. Okay, let's put that there so it'll stay put. Now, in eukaryotic cells, the replication rate is very accurate. You only get one mistake for every 100 million copies, 100 million replications. So the mutation rate is 10 to the minus 8 mutations per copy, per replication. The probability, then, of making a change to a specific amino acid from whatever one you started, a specific code for this amino acid, switch it over to a specific one for another amino acid, is worked out this way. You use the 3.05, you multiply by the mutation rate, but you're changing 3 of them, so you have 3 times 10 to the minus 8, and you raise the thing to 2.16 power. And the result is the probability per replication of moving to another specific amino acid at that point in your protein is 1.87 times 10 to the minus 16. Now, he asks the question, how many replications occur in our biosphere, all the life on Earth, in 300 million years? Why do you choose 300 million years? I think he chose that because that is thought now to be the time between when the Earth cooled off enough to get this sort of, to get amino acids sitting around, to the time you've got life. It's actually quite a bit larger than any time you would have in your standard geologic scheme for producing very big changes in living organisms. Certainly all the Precambrian explosion took place is much less than this, and all the transitions in evolutionary model between the fish to the reptiles to the amphibians, etc., they all took place in much less than this. How many replications take place in that length of time? And then what he's going to do is ask, how many of these new amino acids can you expect to get in that kind of time? Well, here's what he does. He says, it's estimated that the bioactivity on our Earth turns over 10 to the 16th power moles of carbon per year. It cycles that much stuff through living things. He says, let's assume that we got nothing but bacteria doing the cycling, because they do it faster than anybody else does. The average bacterium has 10 to the minus 14th moles of carbon. The average bacterium has in its DNA about 5 million nucleotide pairs. Therefore, the replication rate taking place in our biosphere, if it was all being done by bacteria, which is faster than having other things do it, you would get 10 to the 16th moles times 10 to the 14th bacteria per mole, times 5 times 10 to the 6 nucleotide pairs, times 3 times 10 to the 8 years, you get 1.5 times 10 to the 45 replications in our biosphere in 300 million years. Now, You say, okay, we've got this many replications, and this probability of a change in an amino acid for each nucleotide replication. So you multiply those together, and you ask, how many new amino acids per protein, and in a given protein, how many of those things do you expect to turn up where you specify one amino acid has to be in this place on the DNA, or two has to be in these two places on the DNA, or three have to be in these three places? In other words, you're specifying a particular protein you're going to build. Now, the change in protein from scale to feathers, big change, okay? Here's what we get. If you specify R changes, the probability is the number of replications times this little probability up here raised to the R power. If you want only two changes in 300 million years, you should have 5 times 10 to the 13 cases of those. That sounds quite large, but if you actually divide out the years, that only means about 500 per year on the whole Earth. 500 changes to two specific amino acids you need on Earth. Are they even going to get together? If there are 500 people on Earth, you'd have a hard time finding each other. 500 amino acids in bacteria on Earth. Suppose you go up to 3. You only have 1 chance in 100 of a specific triplet that you call out, 3 amino acids somewhere in a particular amino acid occurring this length of time. You go up to 4, there's only 2 chances in 10 to the 18. You go up to 5, there are only 3 chances in 10 to the minus 34. You say, how much do you need to get anything that works? Well, if I can find the right page in my notes here, I'll tell you. Cytochrome C, rather important biochemical protein that's formed in living things. 27 of the amino acids in that thing are invariable. They've got to be there. 27? That takes you way down that list, and the numbers keep going down as you go down there. Ribonuclease, 31 invariable location, going way down the list again. All of this ignoring the whole problem of a mutation turning the gene off. That's no big deal. Does that a lot of times. And then turning it on while it's any good for anything. There's some real problems right there. Well, I think we'll wind down at this point. Let me see if I can find... Oh, you might be interested in this, since we're ending up our discussions with monkey jokes. I've heard this remark occasionally. Response typically to the claim that how does all this randomness produce order? Remark sometimes made. Give a few monkeys enough time, and they'll eventually type the Encyclopedia Britannica. That might be true. In fact, if evolution is true, that is true. I'm using monkey broadly. So if evolution is true, that's true. Because we developed from the apes, and here we are, and somebody typed the Encyclopedia Britannica. I mean, you know, got there somehow. But that begs a question. You may have noticed that. Suppose you imagine that you're going to have monkeys, and they're going to be given monkey-proof typewriters, electric typewriters, paper already fed in. They're trained to type at 3 characters per second. To give them a break, we're going to give them typewriters that type only caps, the space and the period and the comma and that sort of thing. 33 characters on the typewriter. Trained to type fast, 3 characters per second. That's not fast, but somebody I heard one was doing 12 characters per second. I can hardly type that fast myself. But the 3 characters per second, I could do that. A monkey can do that. They can be trained to do that. Let's have them type, not the Encyclopedia Britannica, but the title. Encyclopedia Britannica. We'll require them to spell it T-A-E-I-A. That's the way the publisher spells it. 3 characters per second. You can take this length of characters, Encyclopedia Britannica, and realize, ask how many combinations that long are there? And there are 26 for the first letter, 33 for the first, because we're going to go with the space and the punctuation. 33 times 33 times 33 times 33 times 33 times 33. How many monkeys do you need? Well, of course, depends on how fast you want to do it. Got enough monkeys, you can do it fast. Got a few monkeys, takes longer. It's like building this building. Pastor said, 3 months? What kind of a job was that? Was that 50 people months needed for that job? Something of that sort. How many monkey years are needed to do this job? Not hard to make calculation. Won't give you the numbers here. I have them in my notes somewhere, but they are. The outcome is this. 30 billion. Monkey years necessary to type Encyclopedia Britannica. Now, everything else, that length, will also be in the stuff. You'll have some trouble finding Encyclopedia Britannica, the output. It's a reminder
that you've got to do an awful lot of random things to get much organization out of anything. I have a more realistic calculation, which is buried in my stuff here somewhere, and that is trying to produce a particular 100 amino acid protein in the earth. I don't see it, so I will not trouble you with that. But the upper shot of it is to give you this sort of result. If you imagine that all the nitrogen in the visible universe is only in amino acids, and all the amino acids are only in 100-linked amino acid chains, and all the amino acid chains are trading partners in such a way as to not make the same chains they made before, at the rate at which an amino acid will move, say, its length at standard temperature, 300 degrees absolute, that there's one chance in 10 to the 28 that you will produce a specified and advanced protein, 100-link protein, in the whole universe in 20 billion years. Suggestion here, there are some serious scientific problems for evolution. I've got a little summary sheet here somewhere, if I can find it. There's a problem of the existence of life. The non-life to life transition appears to be an insurmountable problem. We're not even having much success with human intervention, much less happening by itself. Diversity of life, computer simulation of evolution shows that the present theory of mutation, natural selection, is inadequate. Attempts to computer model evolution and natural selection produce junk, not improving away. Not fast enough, doesn't explain origin of genetic information systems, doesn't deal with the problem of, if you make a change up here, how does the receptor over here know what's changing? And how can random changes preserve and improve information transmission? There's the observational problems, the scarcity of intermediate forms, both now and in the fossil record. The sudden appearance of new forms in the fossil record, though not now, and what we haven't mentioned, but mutation experiments in modern times, apparent boundaries to mutability in modern experiments. And there's the problem, which we mentioned before, of the existence of complex, purposeful organisms, the eye, the wing, the poison fang, the metabolic system, these things. I think we've got excellent evidence that we live in a designed universe, in a created universe. We do not need to fear that somehow, because there are unbelievers who are well-trained academically, who sneer at Christians, that they're right, and that somehow we're wrong. It's not because we're smart, because God has told us what he's done. And we can trust that material is reliable.